Welcome to the Success Coaching Podcast. On today's episode, our guest, Glenn Sanford, shares his own personal journey to success. Because success is a journey, not a destination. Here's the hosts of the Success Coaching Podcast, Todd Foster, Alyssa Stanley, and Kelly Scar.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Success Coaching Podcast. My name is Alyssa Stanley, and I am here with co-hosts Todd Foster and Kelly Scar. Joining us today is none other than Glenn Sanford, who is the CEO, founder, and visionary of eXp World Holdings, the holding company for the fastest growing real estate company in the world. He is also the chief strategy officer at Virbela, which is a virtual world platform for remote work, learning, and events. In late 2020, Glenn purchased Success, where he serves as the company's CEO. Success is a brand dedicated to personal and professional development, and it also turns 125 years in 2022. Welcome, Glenn. Thanks so much for taking some time for us today.
Hey, thanks, Alyssa. Thanks, everyone. Great to be on here today.
So the purpose of this podcast is to really pull back the curtains of success and to show our audience that success is never a straight line to the top. It's full of curves, turns, and maybe a fire here or there, which as entrepreneurs, we all know that happens. So I, for one, am curious, Glenn, before you really found success, who was Glenn?
Yeah, so Kelly, fellow Canadian, I was born actually in Alberta, up in northern, north of Edmonton. And so my parents, my dad, his brother and my grandpa all were in the honey business, and they were beekeepers in northern Alberta and actually northern California. I just happened to be born in northern Alberta. And I lived there till I was three. Then we moved to the lower mainland of British Columbia, so you know, close to an area called Langley and Aldergrove, which is about an hour out of downtown Vancouver, and sort of did my elementary and a little bit of middle school there. And my dad had gotten the granola manufacturing business with my uncle, and they bought a company in 1971 for something like $8,000 in the cereal manufacturing business. And by 1978, they sold it to Kellogg's for, at the time, which was big numbers. Today, it's not as big, but they sold it for about $3 million then to Kellogg's. And then we moved to Oklahoma to invest and lose all that money in the oil and gas business in Oklahoma. So so that was, you know, some of my formative years. I was a geek. I was got my first Apple II computer right when they came out, like within months of the first Apple II computers. My dad bought one. And so I started programming that at a young age, 12, 13 years old. So I really enjoyed computers and enjoyed you really couldn't call it the internet, but I was using a 300 baud modem to dial up other systems, and you know, whether it be CompuServe or The Source. Those are kind of two different online services that you could log into. And so I was an early on adopter of really sort of online tech. And so that was then, and moved to Oklahoma, and I was also a little bit of a chess player, you know, joined the chess club, you know, so I did all the geeky stuff. If there was a geeky thing to do, I was doing it. So that was kind of my early years. I was also into a little bit of long distance running. So I ran really from a young age and did, you know, cross country and the mile, the 2 miles, road runs on the weekends. And even now, like 3 weeks ago, I ran a half marathon in St. George, Utah, just before EXPCon in Las Vegas. So I'm still a runner at 55, and something I still enjoy doing. Bit of a health nut, and I like sort of biohacking in some respects, the term that's got popularized by another Canadian, Dave Ashby. But you know, those are some of the traits that I have. I'm obviously a business guy too. You know, I love businesses and love starting them. It's a very you know, it's actually one of the most democratic things that you can do in the world is start a business, because, you know, to a large extent, you're not being told by anybody you can't do it. And so it's one of the things that, you know, you if you don't, you know, grow up in the right come from the right families or go to the right schools and to get the right jobs, you know, business is like one of those things that literally, you know, is open to anybody. And that's the path I chose, was sort of the business route and just kind of being an entrepreneur and not wanting to work for anybody. So that's a little bit of me.
Were you a self-taught computer programmer, or, as you said, geek, or where did you pick those traits up from?
Yeah, so 1978, 79, you know, my math and science teacher at the middle school that I went to, they both got Apple II computers and brought them to school. And I thought they were really cool. They, you know, so we're talking 48K of RAM. Ours had a 48K of RAM, 2 5.25-inch floppy drives, a green phosphorus monitor, a 9-pin dot matrix printer. But then you couldn't really take computer classes. I mean, there was a little bit that the science and math teacher would do, but for the most part, you were opening up the manuals and you're writing the little programs and making it do something on the screen. And then you'd write another program and you see what it does, and you'd write another program and you see what it does. And so it really was very much of a self-taught and sort of learn as you go kind of exercise.
Glenn, I'm curious, how old were you when you moved to Oklahoma and your dad and your grandpa had invested all of that money into the oil and gas industry?
Yeah, I think we moved there. It was, I think it might've been 1980. It was either 79 or 80. And then in 1980, right after we moved there, Penn Square Bank, which was holding all of the loans for 80-90% of the loans for the oil and gas industry, went through one bank in Oklahoma City, and it went under, and with it, they literally took the economy down, including, I think, the S&L crisis was, you know, sort of came out of that and some other things. So it was, you know, oil had went to something like $40 a barrel at that point. And, you know, of course, you know, everybody was sort of predicting, oh, well, it's going to go to $100 a barrel. So this is the best business to be in. And then, it, you know, eventually went down to whatever, $6 a barrel or something substantially lower than that. And everybody borrowed money on $40 a barrel oil to drill their oil wells. And that didn't work out really well. So I was going through high school. So I graduated high school in 84. So I did my junior and senior year in a little town called Shawnee, Oklahoma. And my sophomore year I did in Oklahoma City. So I was there for 3 years. So we must have moved there in 80. So that would have been the year that we moved there.
So I'm curious, you're obviously old enough to kind of remember that. And I'm curious whether that experience kind of shaped, you know, part of who you are today as a business person.
For sure. Yeah. You know, one of the things I got to experience early on is sort of what happens when a over exuberant market crashes. So we could call it the bubble bursting or what have you. And so oil was definitely in a bubble, and it crashed. I was also in 87. I actually became a stockbroker right after the market crash in 87. And then in 90, there was a little bit more of a market correction as well. And obviously in 2000 was the dot-com crash. And then we had 9/11. And then we had the housing crash. And so probably going up to the housing crash, I had already learned my lesson that once every 10 years, you know, the markets crash, and you don't know which market's going to crash. Sometimes the oil market, sometimes it's the stock market, sometimes it's the housing market, you know, but, you know, these big markets that get overextended, you know, they do crash. So I did learn, a lot about that whole cycle. And, you know, as a business guy, when I look back to 2000, 2009, that's when I started EXP, I literally said, okay, we want to build a recession-proof business, something that, you know, when the next crash takes place, you know, it'll be painful, but it won't put us out of business. I mean, so many businesses had to close during the housing, you know, crisis, and that, you know, we had, and some of it was stuff that would have happened anyway because of the internet. So you think about Borders books, you know, that was probably doomed anyway, but it went down, I think, sort of in that you know, housing market, you know, crash. So you sort of look at, you know, the role of technology, and you look at the fact that markets go up and down, and you look at the idea that, you know, that what's going to replace whatever business that is in the next iteration or after the next crash is going to be, it's going to have to be more efficient than the previous way that the business was done. And so for me, back in 2009, having been, '95, we moved back up right up by the Canadian border back in 86. So my parents moved up, and then I was going to college. Originally, I thought my parents were going to be able to pay for college, but they had lost everything. So, and I didn't get the best grades that I possibly could. So I was, I ended up dropping out and then moving back home with my parents. You know, my parents moved back to the Pacific Northwest in 86, and then I moved back up. But I think for me, it was really just one of sort of paying attention. Even as a kid, I sort of paid attention. I read a lot of books. I was a big, I loved consuming lots of content. In fact, you know, Og Mandino, who actually was one of the publishers of Success Magazine back in, I think, the 70s or 80s, you know, reading his book, like The Greatest Salesman in the World, Zig Ziglar, his books, you know, See at the Top, and then I think How to Sell Anything, I think. Anyway, there I read a lot of Zig, and I really liked, you know, reading what would be considered to be positive mental attitude books, and then just hearing how people made it. So that was kind of a big deal for me, was just seeing how different business people navigated the challenges that they went through. And so everybody went through challenges, and just sort of recognizing that I would be, you know, navigating challenges myself in business as well.
I have a question in regards to your dad and grandfather. So what do they do to recover, and how do they recover from that, both financially and mentally?
Yeah, so my uncle didn't put any of his money into oil and gas, so he did just fine. So he was very conservative with his money, and so he was able to sort of navigate that. And as a result, my grandpa, you know, and grandma, they lived up in Abbotsford, British Columbia, right next door, pretty much to my uncle and aunt, and so they were generally fine. My dad ended up going into helping actually companies sort of pivot and scale, and primarily through public companies. So he, from about the early 90s, probably 90, 91, 92, he was, well, actually it was earlier than that, even in the late 70s, he was, or 80s, he was helping companies structure and then actually merge themselves into public companies, primarily over-the-counter shells. And so that was a business that he did. And I joined him a bit in probably 88, 89, 90, and kind of worked with him off and on through probably until about 97, 98. And so that was kind of his way to make a living. And he would help put these companies together. He would keep a few shares for himself, hoping that these companies would be successful. Unfortunately, almost every one of them wasn't successful, even though the businesses themselves were fine businesses. They just weren't public company appropriate. So they, you know, they ended up going in. There was no real market for those companies because they weren't really trying to fundamentally change or grow to a size that would actually interest the public markets. And so most of them kind of struggled as public companies, and eventually, you know, they either, you know, wound down the public company and went private, et cetera. But I learned a lot through that process. So that was, it was very formative for me. And he makes some other consulting fees doing that. But that was just generally what he did. He did really sort of consulting and helping, you know, companies that wanted to be public because they, the allure of being public is something that a lot of entrepreneurs go, I've made it when I'm public. Well, here, if you want help getting public, then that was what my dad did. And it was his way of making a living there in the 90s.
So as a young man, you saw the ebbs and flows of starting a business and entrepreneurship. You saw one side success and then the other side total and complete loss with an investment. It makes me curious, what made you want to go that path? Because some people would see that and go, whoa, I'm out. I don't, that's too much risk.
Yeah. So I think one of the things, it's a great question because, you know, most businesses starting out don't make it. I mean, if you look at the odds of starting a business and actually being successful with that business, it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty low percentage. So if you're really playing the odds, you know, starting a business is you know, somewhat risky. The other side of it is, though, that if you're around it long enough, you start to understand what makes businesses tick. I mean, that's why they have business schools and all the other things that are out there, is because there are certain aspects of business that actually, if you actually understand it, businesses aren't that risky. So so I got to see, you know, a lot of it. I started initially, actually in 87, I became a stockbroker. And so so I did that in Las Vegas. And then I kind of left there and then came up and worked with my dad up in Blaine, Washington. And so he had a company called Request Financial Services, and I was still a stockbroker for a company at that time called Cullum and Sandow. Actually, it was a different company. Can't remember the name at the moment, but I was a stockbroker, and so I was doing fairly conservative stock picking. But you know, my dad would sort of have me talk to various business people because I was just the in family stockbroker, and every once in a while I'd raise money for some companies. And because I liked the idea, and invariably these are small public companies. Invariably, they ended up not doing as well as they could have. In fact, almost every one of them had to get reorganized and reorganized again. And there's a whole thing. The Vancouver Stock Exchange, which was sort of in my backyard, was that was the whole thing. You put a mining project or oil and gas project in. You speculate, a bunch of people raise money, they go drill or they go try to prove up the property. And invariably, there was nothing there. And then they'd have to go and restructure the shell. And then they go find another project and roll it in. And so, I saw that also with other companies. And so eventually I said, well, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to be outside the company. I'd like to be inside of a company. So I did investor relations work for a couple different companies in the, in the early 90s, probably about 93, 94. And so now I'm on the inside and I'm watching these businesses and I'm watching the like business people who seem to have really great ideas. They'd run some decent sized businesses and they had this sort of, we'll say this brilliance, this inventor mindset, but they sucked at execution. And so I was raising money inside the companies and then eventually I'm like going, I've got to start my own deal. And so eventually I did, I started a couple of companies. One was, basically a web development company, and an online service called Interactive Cafe. And, we rolled that into a small public company. And then because of some internal struggles that we spun back out. And then I started another company called eShippers.com, which was an outsourced e-commerce logistics company in 1998, and wrote the business plan and then raised money for it. And I ended up being a 25% shareholder in the company that I founded. But we raised about $2 million for the company. And it was a great idea, but I had a bonehead of a business partner. So every time I went through these processes, I sort of took notes. This, okay, if I ever do it again, I'm doing it this way, not that way. And so, you know, so the first one was, I'm not going to raise money for companies unless I'm part of the company. Then once I became part of the company, I'm going, I'm not going to raise money for a company unless I start the company. And then I raise money and then I find out I get a boneheaded business plan, a business partner. And then and then my next iteration really was in real estate in 2002 after eShippers. And now I'll go back to the eShippers days. The company I founded, the guy who raised the money, a guy named Wayne Hunter, he raised it, but he really was a golfer. He liked financing and he liked going out and networking, but he didn't really like the idea of really running the company. But I wanted to run the company, and so I wanted to partner with, well, we did partner with United Van Lines and Mayflower Transit, and they actually offered us space. There was a group inside their organization called Insight Logistics, where we were going to use their pick and pack, they were going to use their warehouses for pick and pack fulfillment. So we were doing kind of early on Amazon-y kind of stuff back in 2000, 2001. So we raised a couple million dollars, but Wayne's like, I want the company to be located in Phoenix, Arizona. And the reason why is he's a big golfer, had nothing to do with business. And he made the phrase, he who has the gold makes the rules. Like, okay, well, I guess, you know, I guess I get that. And so we went there. He wouldn't even sign checks to put furniture in the office that we leased down there. So he was, so it was really kind of a boneheaded deal. And then we had a board of directors and we actually were part of a public company and they were blowing off their stock and a bunch of other stuff. So it was lack of a better term, it was a bit of a shit show. So that was kind of the thing. And so when I got out of that in late 2001, I literally made kind of a religious decision that I'm not going to answer to a board of directors or shareholders. And so I ended up doing web design work locally in the Pacific Northwest for small businesses. And one of the people that I did a website for was a local realtor. And he was the top real estate agent in the area. And he started generating leads. I was 35 at the time. He was 63 at the time. And he said, Glenn, you need to get your real estate license. And I'm like, Hugh, I need a real estate license. Like I need a hole in the head. I wasn't super excited about it. And I said, well, nobody makes any money in their first couple of years in the business. I'd already figured out that, you know, it can be a rough start for a business. And so he said, well, what's it going to take? And I said, I don't know, guarantee me $3,000 a month. And then he said, fine. And so that was like, crap. I didn't really want you to say that.
Should have started with a higher number.
Well, I could have, but that was just the first of my demands. So now I'm financially. And then it was, okay, well, I'm not going to sit open houses. I'm not going to wear a realtor pin at the grocery store. I'm going to basically build the business online and it's going to work. It's not going to work. And he said, fine. So now I'm kind of stuck. And then I had to study for my real estate license exam. And so about 30 days later, he goes, Glenn, how come you don't have your license? I said, well, I get paid $60 an hour to do website development work. So I've been focused on that to pay the bills. And he says, I'll pay you $60 an hour to go study for your license. Go get your darn license. So I'm probably the first person in the history of real estate to get paid $60 an hour to actually study for my real estate license exam. But I did that and got my license. And so I was on his team for a bit. And so we had a 2-year deal. And then I went and started my own team. And again, at this point, I'm not answering to shareholders. I have no board of directors. Life is good. I'm really good at the internet lead gen thing because I've been doing sort of internet-based marketing. Even in the 90s, pre-web, I was doing some internet marketing type activities, online services, et cetera. So I really had a good sense of internet marketing. And I also had a good sense of sort of what it took to scale a business and also, just some of the other, and I was decent at sales, having been a stockbroker when I was 21 and 87, et cetera. So I'd kind of developed kind of a full set of skills by that point in time. And so really just worked on building a business. And so then it was build a personal practice. By my fourth full year, 2006, it was the top 50 nationally with Keller Williams. I did $60 million in production which was a good number. Still is a good number, but nowadays we definitely have some teams doing, you know, 2 and 3 times that as just an average large team. So at that time, 60 million was really a hugely respectable number. But now you've got individual agents that can do that type of volume just because of prices, et cetera. So that was kind of it. And then 2008 hit, and I had 6 really top ranked websites around the country. And one of the things that I was trying to do when the market turned was I was trying to sell some of the websites off to real estate brokerages, saying, hey, this would be a great asset for you because it's got all this traffic, it's generating all this lead flow. I was trying to sell them for $100,000, $200,000, which was totally worth it. But nobody took it, that tack. And then I sort of broke down and said, okay, I'm going to take on some shareholders. So 2008 was the first time I took on any shareholders. And we brought on some shareholders into what at the time was called Buyer Tours Realty. And that was to get us from 2008 into 2009. And in 2009, we really said, okay, how do we do this now for this new economy? And that's where we kind of, you know, came up with the business model of EXP with no bricks and mortar, you know, cloud-based revenue sharing program, et cetera. And so we launched that in 2009. So at that point, small number of friends and family shareholders. We weren't a public company, didn't really have a board beyond what was, you know, statutorily required to have a company. And then we just continued to kind of go along for the next few years. And it wasn't until 2013 when we became a public company that we had to actually build a board. So as much as I made a religious decision not to have a board of directors and shareholders to answer to, you know, I at least kept that commitment for the better part of 10, 11 years.
So what was your initial vision in 2009 for EXP compared to now? Is it pretty close?
Well, the general value proposition is pretty much, you know, exactly the same. So mm-hmm. at the time when we put together EXP, I literally said, I looked at all the things that I would have wanted in a real estate brokerage that didn't exist anywhere else in the marketplace. So at the time, you had, you know, the standard fare of real estate brokerages, whether it be the Remaxes, the Keller Williams, the Coldwell Bankers, et cetera. And for the most part, you know, Keller kind of changed the model up a bit because they created their profit share program. But even that failed in 2008, 2009, in that, you know, no offices were really profitable during the downturn. So there was no profit share effectively being paid. But I said, you know, the single biggest cost in real estate time was the physical offices. I'd had 4 in 2008. And we actually closed down 3 of them, went to a skeleton crew on the 4th. And we said, if we can figure out a way to build it without physical offices, we could save a ton of money. And we could actually take some of the savings that we're saving, we could actually pass it back to our agents and brokers in the form of revenue share. And the reason being is I wanted personally to build some sort of residual benefit for my family if something happened to me. Real estate's very unforgiving. If you're the primary breadwinner, if you get hit by a bus, then your family is kind of up a creek. And because it's very much eat what you kill. There's no retirement program, there's nothing really there to sort of support the family, you know, after that. And most real estate agents, as I observed, really didn't have a strong financial background to begin with. So they're living, you know, commission check to commission check. And so if something happened to them, it would be really bad for most agents out there. Even agents, a lot of agents that were making good money, that was still their life. So I'd went and I'd been a personal agent, I'd been a top agent, I'd been a rookie of the year, I'd had all these sort of accolades going on, and I had technically a business in my LLC, and I had the team that was in there, but it wasn't something that would grow beyond me unless I was there. So, you know, a lot of team-based real estate teams that you see all over the country, all over the world, a lot of times they're branded with the name of the agent at the front of that particular team. And that agent is to some extent necessary because they're the drive, they're the ambition, they're the accountability. They're all the things that are necessary for that team to grow and thrive. They need to bring these, you know, agents into their group. They've got to coach them up. They've got to keep them sort of on task. They got to bring on the staff, the whole nine yards, but it's all based on the persona of one person. So I just saw that as being not a flaw in the real estate model. And of course, if you go in and you interview, and of course, Kelly can probably speak to this as well, but you know, they when they recruit you, they say you have a real estate business now. And yet at the same, in reality, you have a business, you don't have a business, a business has you, because, the fact is that, you know, the business owns you. If you're not producing, the business doesn't make any money. And so you are the business. So that was, you know, that was one of the sort of the other pieces of it. We wanted to figure out a way to actually get agents off the hamster wheel of deal to deal. And me included, and the way that I saw being able to get off the hamster wheel is actually starting a business that solved the biggest pain point for realtors, which was there's no retirement in the business. That was the thing that we thought would solve it. I knew it would solve it for me, and I figured there was enough other me's out there that that it would actually take on a life of its own. So now, you know, if something happens to me, I decide to retire, whatever, the business model will still continue to go, grow and run and for probably multi-generational. I don't think there's a whole bunch of stuff that we could do to sort of screw that up. I'm sure we could think of some things, but for the most part, I think it's got a lot of potential to be a multi-generational business that, you know, impacts, you know, families for decades to come.
It certainly is a disruptive model. There's no question about it. There seems to be a lot of room in the sandbox to play, with this style, not just a cloud-based model, but, you know, RevShare, there's, you know, Real Brokerage, there's Fathom Realty, there's a couple of different players now kind of in the space that are, for lack of a better term, I guess, are indeed EXP's kind of business model and kind of made it their own. Do you see the older brokerages, the Century 21s, or perhaps that's not a great example, as, you know, they're owned by Realogy, but, you know, the Remaxes, the Keller Williams, you know, the Royal LePage, some of these older brands, do you see them kind of shifting their model to be able to compete? Because it does seem like some of these older brands seem to be losing a lot of ground to, you know, some of these newer models that are starting to emerge.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the challenges that I think the industry has in general is they were all set up to sell franchises. And so whether you think about Keller Williams, Remax, Century 21, all the Realogy brands, Berkshire Hathaway, you know, et cetera, they all were designed to sell these franchises. And the franchise agreements pretty much has a bricks and mortar based requirement. It has a certain territory that's attached to it. It's got all these rules attached to it. And those rules go both directions. So they go to the franchisee, but they also, you know, have impact on the franchisor. And I think that's one of the big challenges. Like Keller, you know, and I don't know exactly what they'll do. They're certainly coming up with some other strategies around their model, but they've looked at creating the virtual market center. And they got a lot of pushback internally, is what I hear, and so that pushback has stopped them from actually launching it. So Gary Keller announced his virtual market center at least 3 or 4 years ago, and it was, you know, to a large extent a way to try to answer the challenge where he was losing agents to EXP probably more than any other single brand. And in fact, I don't think they sort of had an attrition problem before we came along. But they've tried to come up with that, and the franchisees, I think, revolted because they're locked into 5 and 10 year franchise agreements. They've got these handcuffs, and then the franchisor was potentially going to compete with them. And I think that's one of the fundamental challenges for the big franchisor. So I think what we're going to see is we're already seeing it. I mean, you said R&D, which in the real estate world stands for rip off and duplicate. So we've got some, you know, copycats that are, you know, literally took our exact model and, you know, they're competing on price and that's their whole thing. You know, it's like, well, we're just going to be EXP, but we're going to be cheaper. And what's the phrase we've all heard, especially in sales and coaching is, you know, in the absence of value, what do you compete on? Price. So I think where we're kind of continuing to innovate and continuing to do things, I think that first mover's advantage will allow us to, you know, continue to do some really interesting stuff over time. And so, you know, but we'll see. We've got Real. There's another company called CR Realty. There's another company in Florida. I can't remember the name of it, but there's all of these companies that are sort of popping up. And Keller had the same thing happen, by the way. So when Keller was growing, there was a whole bunch of companies that created a profit share model. Almost all of them, I think, have went out of business because, you know, it's one thing when you're the innovator, but, you know, you sort of look at even like Remax, you know, there's really not like a number two to Remax. Now, you could maybe look at Realty Executives. They're like 1/10, 1/20 of the size. But that's like their next competitor. So, you know, once somebody sort of creates a new model in the space, they end up, you know, getting, you know, 80, 90% of that new space ends up being with that, you know, that brokerage.
Glenn, for a while now, the trend seems to be that privately held real estate companies choose to go from a private company to a publicly held company. There's also privately held real estate companies that have stated in the past that they would never go public. There's a lot of speculation that they will indeed go public in the near future. My question is, could you explain to us what the disadvantages of going from a private to a public company are, or if there are any?
You know, to be a public company, you have to have a really compelling reason to be public. So there's two reasons that you go public. One, you're too big for anybody to buy you if you want an exit strategy. So you're just that's one. If you don't want an exit strategy, then there's no need to even consider going public. But if you want an exit strategy and you get so large, then you want to go public. The other reason is you're growing. Well, there may be a third reason. I'll mention that one here in a minute. But you're growing so fast that the ability to raise money, you can in the public markets, they might give you a significant premium, sort of giving you the ability to raise money as if you're 3 or 4 years down the road, as opposed to where you're at right now. Right now, you know, if you're a private company and you go raise money, to a large extent, with, you know, unless you get into sophisticated institutions that really like the space, you're going to be raising money based on last year's profit and loss statement. And they're not going to give you a lot of credit for future growth. Now, they'll give you some credit. That's why they'll invest in you. But you really don't get that valuation jump. The third reason that I think is worth being public, and this is the reason why we became a public company. We didn't raise any money from institutional investors. We didn't need an exit strategy for myself. But we raised it specifically because I wanted all of our agents and brokers to also be shareholders. So we actually bought a public company, never raised any money from Wall Street, and we started to then give shares to our agents. So that was the third reason. But when I sort of think about companies going public, one, you want that valuation boost that you get if you're fast growing. So right now we're growing, you know, 70, 80, 90, 100% over year as a company. We've been doing that consistently for many years. And so for us, that gives us a big valuation bump because investors can sort of look at the fact that in 5 years, our P&L should be X in their mind, which means that the company will then be worth Y. And if it's going to be worth, the company's going to be worth that. And today it's worth, you know, something less than Y, and it's better than interest in the bank, then why not buy EXP stock today? And that's kind of the idea. And it's called a discounted cash flow analysis, where you sort of take the future cash flows and then you discount 15% you know, for multiple years. And that comes back to sort of giving you a net present value for a company. But that's one of the things that's a big benefit for us. You know, Compass just, they just went public. So they went public at $18 a share. They're now less than $10 a share. They're nine something. Yesterday they were. And their market cap is now, you know, under $4 billion. And they did a raise, private raise at $4 billion valuation when they were private. And then they did another small raise, comparatively speaking, when they went public, smaller than I think they were hoping for. But they raised some money. But they're going to be kind of hooped in this public market space because I think the public markets are already starting to assume that Compass is going to need money long before they're profitable. And, you know, because they are burning, you know, $100 million, $200 million a quarter, and they only have, you know, $200 or $300 million on their balance sheet. So it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out that they're going to need to raise some money. Now you look at, you know, another company rumored to go to that has eyes of going public is Keller Williams, and they've sort of created KWX, and they've brought in, you know, somebody to be sort of the lead or CEO of the holding company. And so the question is it a private equity play, or is it a public markets play? And, you know, right now, you know, you look at real estate stocks in general, they've all been trending down here recently. So, you know, didn't help that Zillow decided to lose $500 million in the iBuyer space. But with that, you know, the market, you know, took a bit of a hit. And I think it's sort of spilled over that, you know, the markets might have been a little overvalued. So you got, you know, Open Door is coming down hard. You got, you know, EXP has been sort of in that draft down as well. So our market cap is still the largest of all organized real estate companies. So you know, it's bigger than Compass, bigger than Redfin, bigger than Realty, bigger than Remax. And so we've got this fairly large market cap. Zillow's got the biggest market cap in the space, followed by Open Door. But they're not in traditional real estate brokerages with agents. So what I see is like, you know, is the market ripe for Keller to be public? They might be missing their window to be public. You know, if we see higher interest rates, which we are, Realtor.com just came up with some stats about a softer housing market in 2022, and you've got sort of this backdrop of a slower housing market, then, you know, investors are going to factor in the future numbers a lot lower than they would have looked at it like 6 or 10 months ago. Like 6 or 10 months ago would have been ideal. Like if they could have went public in February this year, I think they would have been golden, but you know, trying to go public in February next year, you know, it might mean half the market cap value in terms of the price that they go public at.
So let's say KW does go public. Do you see it boosting in the short term anyone's IPO and stock prices, or do you think that it could be actually bring those down?
So what it would do is it would open up Keller's books entirely from a Keller Williams international perspective. So, you know, nobody really knows what's in those books. Like we all know, if you were at a market center level, you knew what the market center profit was. You knew a little bit about what the global profit share was for you know, Keller Williams, and you knew agent count, but you didn't actually know, you know, where Keller Williams stood in terms of net profitability. So I think there's a question, you know, how much do you want to open up that kimono from a Gary Keller perspective? I think it's a double-edged sword. I think there's definitely benefits to doing that for Gary personally, but I think there's also some challenges to you know, over revealing your business. And I know some of the businesses aren't actually being rolled into KWX. Like I'm not sure if Maps is being rolled in there, and so that, you know, that suggests that Maps is probably quite profitable.
What challenges do you see that Gary Keller faces as a founder of a company that may go public that has been privately held for close to 40 years.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, you have to, I think he's got some challenges where he basically said he'd never be answering to Wall Street as a company. And he sort of made that statement over the years. So he kind of painted himself into a bit of a corner with that. And so then the question is what is Gary's long-term exit strategy? Like, you know, he's certainly turned over the top post in Keller Williams. I mean, talk about a revolving door, it seems that, you know, if he can't find good leadership that he can get along with long-term, but then, you know, it's still got Keller Williams, like it's his name on the shingle. And so I think I could see him going public, but I see it creating a lot of challenges for him just based on past statements.
As a franchise company, what hurdles need to be considered when there's franchisees and capped models in the mix?
My guess is that nobody gets money except whoever owns KWX shares. And so I don't think there's a way, like independent contractors, if you think about, like, let's say he wanted to go public to do the same thing that EXP does. Like, he wants to make agent shareholders. Noble idea. However, if you think about it, how do you distribute shares to these folks? And then they don't even have a direct relationship with Keller Williams International. They're franchisees or they're agents of a local franchisee. So, you know, how do you do the share swap? And I have no idea what his ultimate goal is, but, you know, you go down the path and then you get to a point where you have to make a decision. And, you know, my guess is he probably will. He's probably got too much sunk cost in the decisions he's made, but I'm not sure it's the right decision.
If you're enjoying this episode, please rate, review, follow, and subscribe to the Success Coaching Podcast.
The public real estate companies all kind of have the same business model. And that is just to own real estate brokerages. There's no ancillary business models or business units that have been spun off. Like Remax just owns Remax and that's it. Realogy might be the exception of that rule. I know that they own a bunch of title companies as well as, you know, Coldwell Banker and Century 21 and Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate and ERA and a bunch of different brands. But ultimately, they're just all real estate brokerages, whereas with what you've created, Glenn, is you own Verbella and Success and, you know, EXP and, you know, Success Lending now, Success Coaching now, you know, all of these different business units. Do you think that is, you know, and like I've said this to a couple of different people talking about real brokerage, you know, again, they're playing in the space. They're, like you have mentioned, you know, kind of a reduced cost imitator of the company that you started. But, you know, ultimately, they're also just a real estate brokerage and that's it. Do you think that the future of, you know, kind of coming back to this question that I had before about playing in the sandbox is providing all of these ancillary benefits and business units to the agents and contributing to the overall revenue, and which then ultimately, you know, is going to increase the cost of the share?
Yeah. So I think, I don't particularly want to talk too much about real, but they've already said they're going to get in the title and mortgage and business. They want to own a title company outright and do that. So I think it's natural. I mean, Keller's got Keller Mortgage, and so you got and Remax does have Motto Mortgage, so they do have that. And, but I think you do become a one-stop shop. Realogy has their deal with guaranteed rate, so they all have sort of different flavors of it. I think the at the end of the day, you do have to figure out, you know, how to get to some sort of critical mass, and then you also then once you've got a certain number of agents on your platform, then it's now a matter of adding value where you can in the right way. And so when we think about things like mortgage, title and escrow, we're looking at insurance, health insurance, and other things for real estate professionals. Right now, we've got a health cooperative that we roll out in the U.S., but to be able to have that, of course, in Canada, insurance is a little bit different animal. But I was sort of thinking about, you know, all the things that we can sort of bring and be kind of this overall marketplace for products and services that agents and their customers might want and need, but not sort of be saying this is what you need to you have to do. So I think that as we grow, like right now we're, if you count Canada, we're probably 71,000 agents, you know, North America. And you start to think about, you know, all the difference in products and services that, you know, can come from there. But then you go another year out and now we're 130,000 agents or some or 120,000, some number next year. And then you go another year out and now we're, you know, pushing closer to 200,000 agents. So you sort of just do that math and then you start to just think about all the things that you can naturally just put in it and that there will be some natural consumption of those products and services if they exist inside the same ecosystem. And then if our agents are also our shareholders, they get the extra benefit that every time one of those services are used, it further enhances the value prop and the share value, et cetera.
You know, we've talked a lot about brick and mortar and how it relates to real estate companies and, you know, success, whether they're successful or not, whether that's the actual future. It's interesting to me that you guys came up with the concept for Success Spaces. So can you maybe run us through that a little bit, Glenn, and, give us an understanding as to what that actually is?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we've been working on for years is trying to come up with a brand for a co-working company. So this is EXP Realty and Holdings. And the reason why is there's a lot of, we provide all of our agents with access to the Regis network. So we're a big user of Regis and you can get a Regis card and drop in any Regis anywhere in the world with the Regis card that we provide, which is a great benefit. But we also have, broker owners converting their offices over to EXP and they're like, what do we do with our offices? We played with the idea that a co-working concept would make a ton of sense for their offices. So, you know, instead of being a real estate office, you're a co-working office. And if agents want to come in, agents use co-working spaces all the time. They could have this other business that now actually provides benefits to the to a larger entrepreneur and business community in their local marketplaces, which is actually really beneficial also to the real estate industry. So we said, hey, you could always turn your office into a co-working space. And we came up with a number of different concepts over the years, but nothing really quite stuck. And then when we bought Success, it's like, oh, this is the perfect brand because you can now, you know, on the walls, put up the covers of the various magazines. You can bring in all that content. I mean, we've got, I don't even know the content library that we own, but it's huge of content. So you get access to a huge library of content as a member. And then by embedding a certified success coach in the space, you've got somebody who actually has a vested interest in helping people succeed in there, not just sell them a desk or sell them some time or just make money from the cafe, et cetera. So the idea is really that it kind of serves a whole bunch of different business prospects and franchise sales are going actually really well. They've been coming together. We've got, first ones will be opening up mid-late 2022. But we've already got, number of contracts signed. We've got spaces that are leased. And now it's just a matter of going through the build out and then helping these first franchisees get into business, but it's an amazing concept. And in my opinion, for those type of people who always wanted to be in the co-working business and have an affinity to personal development, it's like the perfect intersection of having a co-work space, having something available to your local community, and having something attached to, you know, as I said, personal development and being more successful.
So are you looking to branch with success even to more things?
It could be, you know, I think it's now a matter of sort of digesting what we've already expanded into and then seeing if there's some additional adjacencies that we want to use the success brand in. But, you know, having, you know, the longest running personal development brand in existence outside of the Bible,
yeah,
you know, it's pretty amazing what you can sort of think about the number of lives it can impact.
When you went public with eXp, did you have a goal as if it'd be great if we have a valuation of 500 million or a billion, or has it exceeded your expectations more than you thought?
Yeah, so it definitely exceeded my expectations. When we went public initially, and we did it through a reverse merge of a public shell, but at the time, I think we had 47 million shares, I think something like that, and we were about 20 cents a share is where we did that at. So we had about a $9.4 million valuation, and so, you know, and we believe that, I think where I sort of thought about it is that if we could get to a $5 valuation, that would be pretty amazing. And that would have been a company valuation of 230 million or something like that. So that was a number that, you know, and it was a pretty big number for me too, because that number, it was a kind of emotional day when we hit a $5 price target, because it pushed me, and not that the number was reason why I was doing it, but it pushed my personal net worth to something like $100 million, something like that. So it was like a crazy number, and I'm like, this is crazy money. Like, I've never ever in my wildest imagination thought that I'd have, even on paper, because there's a difference between paper money and real money, but even on paper, I never thought that I'd have a $100 million valuation. Personally, when we started eXp or what have you, I thought, you know, I got 30 or 40 or $50 million. For me, that was a home run. And it is. It's a home run for pretty much anybody. So then it hit that, and then it's like, that's a big number. And then of course now it's added another zero to that, and then it's like, I don't even know what to think about that, because I don't, you know, 90% of that is not money that I'll probably ever use.
When you look at that number, does it feel real? And my second thing is, do you think differently about spending money, or is it still thinking about that? Because I would think almost like $1,000 to billionaire would be almost a penny.
Right.
So does your mindset completely change over, or does it get in your head, holy cow, what am I going to do with this? Is it more stress than it actually is joy?
Yeah. So certain things are different for sure. I mean, you know, now when I close shop, I really don't look at the price tag. Like it's not, you know, whether a pair of jeans costs $70 or $200 is a non-issue. So, mm-hmm. you know, so that's kind of a, you know, so that's kind of a change. Debbie, of course, she's got a lot more fashion sense than I do. So she does get me some nice looking stuff. I was wearing some shoes the other day, and, I would never have been caught dead in these shoes like years ago, and they're this sort of patchwork shoe. It's got all these. It looks like a patchwork quilt, but it's actually done on a shoe. So I was like, okay, well, I'll wear it, I guess. but I don't really want to wear it in public, like in a normal setting, because it's like it's just a little bit like not normal. But you know, I look at my credit card statement every month. I look at my personal spending hasn't increased that much, but I do get to where I'm going sometimes traveling a little nicer than I used to, and at the same time, like we were coming back from Las Vegas from ExpCon, and we went to LA initially, and so flew from LA to LAX for $59 on Southwest. So they just opened up Southwest just opened up in Bellingham, Washington, and so like we're gonna fly Southwest today. So well for you know so I flew Southwest from LAX, connected in Oakland, waited for a couple hours till the next plane, you know, for the plane change and flew up. And you know, I could have done it private, but it would have been $10,000 versus $235. And it probably wouldn't have made that much of a difference to me from a lifestyle perspective, if any, but I still like to fly commercial, you know, a fair bit.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's almost like when you hit the lottery and you've always dreamt of it and now you hit it and now what happens? And if you look at most lottery winners, it doesn't happen to turn out very well for them. And I always thought about the mindset of that, of exactly how that feels, because on my feeling, I think I'd almost become freaking out about it a little bit.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, one of the things I've realized is when somebody, like I have a fairly giving nature. So if somebody asks for help and, you know, a charity, I've given a lot of charity, I've done, made a few investments this year. And I've probably noticed this year specifically that I'm not sure how solid a lot of those, like certainly charitable giving makes sense. I would have done that anyway. I'm starting to sort of look at, you know, am I just investing in things because people are asking me to, or am I doing it because they're actually good investments? And I think one of the reasons why lottery winners, the pro sports, you know, a lot of people, they end up kind of messing it up a bit because they end up throwing money at a whole bunch of stuff. And then they end up there with a tax bill. Like I'm even looking at my own personal tax bill and it's going to be substantial. I mean, we're talking, you know, 8-figure tax bill for this year. And I'm going, okay, well, I've done all this stuff. And I'm like going, crap, where's my money for taxes? And so, you end up recognizing that, that you have to run your personal finances as if it's a business. And I think that's kind of my mindset understanding this year. Like if I would have went and did a big exit and taken all my money out, might have hurt me in some respects because it would have been like hitting the lottery. But you know, I've got a small amount. I'm selling like 1.5% of my total EXP holdings every year. So very small percentage, but it's still a decent size, you know, financial number. But it is teaching me a little bit about my own money and how to make sure that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm able to, you know, pass on some of that to my kids as opposed to, you know, potentially blowing it like my dad did.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that in the back of your head that maybe this could all go away eventually, that fear?
Well, I don't know that I actually don't think that, but I do. I'm very good personally at watching what somebody does and learning from it, especially if that was the wrong decision. Like a lot of times you don't learn as much from people when they make the right decisions because you don't, you know, but you know, so if you see a whole bunch of people doing a lot of things and they're, when they make the right decisions, like, yeah, those are good decisions, but they were good decisions for a particular reason at that particular moment. But when they make a bad decision, it really sort of, I think, more crystallizes what works and what doesn't work better than seeing what does work. Because it's what does work usually only works for a finite period of time. What doesn't work tends to have some sort of recurring theme attached to it. A lot of this comes from some of the economics. You know, there was an economics that anytime there's somebody has an economic benefit doing something, there'll always be competitors that will erode that economic benefit. So if I go in there and do the exact same thing, that doesn't mean that I'm destined for success. It means that, you know, that I'll probably have some success for a period of time, but you didn't do it for the right reason. You were doing it like, and so we go back and look at, you know, one company we were talking about earlier, they're doing it because they think there's an economic benefit to doing it for copying a company because there's so much benefit that we've enjoyed. But that doesn't mean that they're going to enjoy it, and they may end up, you know, hitting their head on a brick wall or something at the end of the day because you know, they may not have the momentum. They're certainly not going to get all of the amazing leaders that we already have at eXp because, you know, for the most part, you know, once you're in the eXp ecosystem, you're pretty much a lifer. You know, it's pretty hard to sort of, unless we fundamentally do something morally reprehensible as a company, you're gonna want to stay with it because there's so many benefits that you're enjoying at this point.
You know, I want to touch on something that I believe will keep eXp above competition all time, because when we talked earlier about your vision of eXp and why you wanted to start it, there was so much heart and purpose behind it. It wasn't, you know, Glenn at a younger age saying, I want to be a millionaire in so many years. I want to be a billionaire in so many years. You wanted to start this business because you are the ultimate problem solver. And solving that problem was, I don't ever want a family to lose all of their money because a brokerage goes down. Like, I want to affect people, generational wealth, make an impact in this world. And I think that will always set eXp above the competition. And now you've acquired Success Magazine and Success Coaching. So I'm curious if that vision copacetically goes across the board, or if you have a different vision for Success Magazine and Success Coaching.
No, I think it's the same overall vision. You know, one of the things, and many of you heard me say it before, but I don't really want to have businesses that compete with the business. So 100% of everything that I do is in eXp World Holdings. So in terms of what takes my mind share, now there may be a point in time when I retire and somebody takes the reins and runs the company. But at this point in time, everything that I do is in here. And so, like, Success Magazine is something I had an opportunity to buy it myself. In fact, technically, I owned it for 30 days myself before eXp actually became the actual owner of the magazine. And it was more from a logistical standpoint, I could move a lot faster personally than the public company could move in terms of an acquisition. And there was a very short time fuse attached to the acquisition. So I did that. But the ultimate goal was to get into eXp World Holdings hands because eXp is my long-term vehicle for all good things. The other thing is that Success, if you think about an agent, agents, good agents, great agents, maybe not good agents, but certainly great agents, they're all filling their mind with positive, motivating content. They've probably got a coach. They've got some sort of accountability system. But they're also then filling their mind with positive content. And Success Magazine, for me, as a business professional, as a real estate professional, it was a magazine I would pick up from time to time, grab the CD, I subscribed to it for a period of time, et cetera. And for me, it was just naturally matched up with the mindset of a great agent. And when I was offered the opportunity to acquire it, it made sense to pull it in. There were a couple of reasons. One, in eXp, we don't have a professional coaching and training arm. Now, we do have a training arm of the company. It is professional, but we don't charge for it. And that was by design. That was to some extent to sort of set side by side with other companies where they charge for their training and their coaching. But then when we got the opportunity to buy Success, it sort of created another platform where we could take it up a level and now say, okay, here's where the premium stuff, where a coach won't come in and coach on a relative stipend. They do want and deserve to be paid something more akin to premium coaching. That's their livelihood. This is how they make a living. They've done the research. They've spent countless years, if not decades, honing their craft, and they want a platform to actually get that out into the marketplace. And so you know, Success made total sense when you think about all the people. We got the 125th year anniversary cover coming out, and you got, you know, whether it be the Tony Robbins or the Peter Diamandis or the Mel Robbins or and you go back in time to Napoleon Hill to to the original founding of the magazine, you see all these personas. If you were in personal development, helping people be great at what they do, not just be good, but be great at what they do, then you really wanted to be, you know, involved with that, you know, magazine being success.
So I'm curious, do you have a coach, and who has been your most influential coach or leadership personnel in your life?
I look at it kind of a couple of different ways. One, I've had some amazing mentors in business. And so it was sort of on the job coaching. So my first, when I became a stockbroker in 87, I worked for a gentleman named Herman Gralick. And so he was from New York. He really had a phenomenal work ethic. I think his daughter was an attorney. His son was a doctor. And this guy got up at five. He worked until like nine at night before he went to bed. Probably he might have took 1 or 2 hours to sort of for whatever, some social activities. But he was just this complete workaholic. He was also my roommate in Las Vegas, which was probably not the best move on my part, but at the same time, it was probably the best thing that could happen to me. And so Herman was, while I was taking the stockbroker exam, I was doing all the practice exams, and Herman would go in over the answers the next morning before I got up. So he's up at five. I'm getting up about 5:30. But he would, if I missed questions that I shouldn't have missed because I had to go study for the exam, he literally woke up probably the neighborhood with, "Sanford, how the F did you miss this question?" And that's how I woke up for 6 months. I had him as my roommate. And so I went from being I graduated high school with a 192, by the way. And I basically flunked out my first couple of years of university. So, you know, in 86, I moved in with my parents. 87, I took this job as a stockbroker after being sort of a manager of a bar. And I was doing some community college stuff. But then I was with him for 6 months. And then I was a stockbroker back up home in the Pacific Northwest. But then I decided to go back to university, which only went for another year. I wasn't really good at the whole university part. But when I went back, I went from flunking out to being on the dean's honor roll, and kids not even wanting me in their class because I was setting the curve in the class. So he really kind of created a huge, huge work ethic for me. So he was probably a big one. The other one was probably the other biggest influencer was a guy named Jerry Solberg, who's passed away now, but he was in the mid 90s. He had run a portion of Kerry Packer, Australian billionaire, part of his businesses he ran. And he was just an amazing sort of business thought leader, engineer, CEO. And so I got to be not coached directly by him, but I was around him, you know, and so he really helped up-level my thinking in a lot of different ways. And then I was also, as a coach, coaching thing, I was also always into sports, primarily judo. And at the same time, I'm listening to audios. So like I listen to all of Tom Hopkins stuff. So, you know, some of you got a chance maybe to see him a couple of weeks ago in Las Vegas. But, you know, I listened to his stuff religiously, and I was practicing the scripts and dialogues. And I was always putting myself into uncomfortable situations because I wanted to master the art of selling. So I never really, I did hire a couple of coaches over the years, but I'm moving so fast that the coaches were having trouble keeping up with me. So it was kind of a little bit of a strange conundrum for them. But, you know, what I can tell you is I'm probably as well-read as anyone out there as it comes to, you know, whether it be well-read and also really good at implementing. So like 7 Habits of Highly Effective People was my Bible for years. And I would literally sort of operate with that. Now I'm using more of an OKR style. So, you know, you may have seen I know you guys have seen the success achievement system and the Trello boards and the way that's all stuff that I've developed because it worked for me and the teams I worked on. and the OKR systems. And so I'm always about reading something and implementing. And so I have zero fear of implementation, whereas I think a lot of people struggle with, they read it, now they but they aren't confident enough in their own ability to go implement it. And so I think that's where the coaching is probably the super impactful, when somebody can really hold you accountable to actually put that new system in place, put that new strategy, develop the new habits, make sure that you're really sort of taking yourself to the next level. So, you know, eventually, if you don't have a coach, you can truly be self-sufficient in what you're doing.
Well, Glenn, we have a great coach for you at Success Coaching. So,
yeah. Sounds good.
We actually threw out this question to our coaches to see if they had any questions that they wanted to, have us ask you. And one that kind of continually sticks out at me here is presented by Dago. He's one of our coaches. He said, undoubtedly, eXp is on its way to becoming the number one company in real estate. How is eXp positioning itself to continue to be the disruptor and not be disrupted in the future?
Well, one is just to try to be a day one company. So, you know, Jeff Bezos, I don't know if you guys know, he basically, you know, made headlines by saying that, you know, Bezos predicts that he will get disrupted. And if you think about it, you know, what companies have made it more than like 50 or 100 years? Like, not many. I mean, they may be, but they're sort of a, you know, some shell of their former existence inside of maybe another company. You know, some of the longest running companies in the United States, you know, came out of, you know, when there was electricity. So you got, you know, GE, you got IBM, you got a few companies that have sort of lasted long term. So what I like about Jeff Bezos' comment about being a day one company is that if you don't recognize the need to be a day one company, you might start to rest on the laurels of who you were. And I think that's, you know, if you think about, you know, in real estate, we've all been around, you know, Century 21, we used to be the largest real estate brokerage in the United States, at least, and maybe the world. And then I think, you know, RE/MAX was certainly one of the largest, if not the largest. And Coldwell Banker, you know, was the largest, if not the largest. And then now you've got Keller Williams, you know, that became the largest. And, you know, in my opinion, by 2024, we'll be larger than Keller. So then that's sort of just looking at the math. And if the math holds true, then in 2024, we'll be the largest single real estate brand in the world. And I think it cuts both ways. I think the size does have some challenges that come with it. You know, when I'm in there with a small team running in my local marketplace, I can pivot really quickly. The larger you get, the less easy it is to pivot. And so I think, you know, if you think about companies that have, you know, similar comp models to EXPs, I mean, you know, there's companies like, you know, Amway. Is, you know, it's still a very, very large company, but it's not the growing company that it was years ago. It still provides a great opportunity for people who want to take advantage of it. If they want to build inside of that system, there's opportunities to do that, but it's not the opportunity it was, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and maybe even the 90s. It's a different opportunity, but it's a safe opportunity. It's very systematic. It's very, very straightforward. So then you think about, you know, what disrupts us. Obviously, you get to a certain size and you have certain trappings of your model. Ours is rev share and equity. You know, maybe the disruption has to do with crypto. You know, but we don't know what that next disruption is going to be. Who knew in 1984 when Keller Williams started that the internet was going to change everything, you know, and by 2020, there'd be zero reason to physically have to go and set up a physical office to run a real estate brokerage. Now you can still do it, It still makes a decent living for people who do that. But the opportunity is way bigger for somebody if they're ambitious in a model more like EXP than it would be to go sort of, we'll call it the safe route of Keller. So when we become safe, I think that's when we're probably the most likely to face disruptive influences. And at that point in time, it'll be on us to figure out a way to pivot in the face of those disruptions. The one thing we have on our side, which is huge, and I talked about it earlier, is we're not a franchise. So we actually do have the ability through our agreements with our agents, through all kinds of different things, to actually be able to pivot as needed, if needed. And I don't know what that if is or what that possibility could be, but we do have the ability to make various changes to the model, to adopt different things, and we can do it corporately without having to go through a lot of bureaucracy that a franchise system creates.
You stated in the past that the market crashes about every 10 years. Do you consider what the entire world went through last year as a crash, or are you still looking for that crash? Because if you look at the financial housing crash, it's been, 12, 13 years ago. And if you do see something happening there, do you have a plan in place on the what if that does happen for EXP?
Yeah. So one thing, we're really well positioned to weather a crash. So the way we've designed the model, it's I don't want to say it's crash proof, but it's as close to crash proof as we could design it. So our Achilles heel right now, but it's the Achilles heel of literally any modern day company, is if the internet goes down. Like that's our biggest risk. But you think about what doesn't get disrupted, like if the internet goes down for long periods of time, like more than say 2 weeks, say it goes on for like 6 months. Now how do you run a business that's all where you have to have access to the internet? Like we rely on cloud-based services for very pretty much everything that we do. Now, the internet's built in a way that it fundamentally shouldn't ever go down because it's really just peer-to-peer connections. And I don't know exactly how the internet goes down because there's no central internet authority that you can sort of take out. But, maybe there's a virus that somehow infects every single, network operation center in the country. So that would be somewhat problematic. Let's say that we're definitely have higher inflation than we've seen in 35 years right now. A lot of that has to do with the supply chain constraints, not because of the overinflation of money, even though that creates some additional pressure. So we'll see some things kind of have issues because of that, but we could fundamentally still operate at 50% of our current national sales volumes and probably still even be a profitable real estate brokerage. Now, not a given, but almost all of our costs are variable, not fixed. So we're able to sort of scale down expenses as necessary.
I see why EXP and everything that you have is going great because of the person you are. And you are just a really, really nice guy.
Thanks. And I everybody's got a different management style, but I think there's reasons for each style. Like there's certain parts of the organization that in the past, my nice guy style didn't work. So I had to bring somebody in to not be so nice.
Does anything upset you? And if you do get upset, Glenn, how do you respond or react?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know, when I'm stressed out, but right now I think things are so good for me personally that I don't get too stressed out. I got a new app on my phone here recently. And it's called Humanity. It's a paid app. It's sort of help extend your health span or lifespan, supposedly, in terms of just your daily activities. And so it's got me, meditating, probably 30, 40 minutes a day. And it's got me making sure I get my 4 to 5 mile run in every day. And it's got me, you know, it's now got, they just added the nutritional side. So it's kind of mapping in my intermittent fasting. And so it's got a lot of these sorts of things. So, but I think, you know, I've got a kind of a meditative personality style. And one of the things that if you do are a meditator or have been or thinking about it, I think one of the benefits of meditating is that you have to understand that a lot of the thoughts that you have in your head around, that stress you out are just to some extent made up thoughts, made up by somebody else, made up by yourself, made up by whoever, whatever it is. And so if you can start to just kind of just be able to learn to just breathe and just recognize that whatever it is, you know, it just is. And whatever the outcome is going to be the outcome. And there's not a whole bunch you can do about it. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't stress or what have you. I've stressed a lot over the years. But I've also recognized that the CEO role in a company is one of the roles that actually has one of the shortest longevities of individuals. So because of the stress of being a CEO. So one of the things, if you recognize that, you can also be proactive in trying to figure out ways to either not stress or de-stress in ways that, you know, help put your body back together.
If I just had 1% of your calmness, my life would be completely different.
You seem pretty calm. You're doing great, Todd.
He hides it very, very well.
Well, I could be hiding it. This could be a total illusion.
Yeah.
Just for this podcast.
Yeah.
As a billionaire, do you have like Mark Cuban calling you up asking if you want to go hang out?
No. You know, ironically, you know, I think I was close to, if not hit the sort of billionaire status, but somebody tried to connect me with Mark Cuban, and Mark's not the easiest guy to connect with. Like he definitely has lots of, like he wanted to know an agenda, what we're going to talk about. And I'm like, I just want to meet you. You know, so. So I've not met Mark Cuban yet.
Is there someone that you've met because of who you are now that you've always desired to meet?
Well, not because of the billionaire status, but just because of being in the real estate space. I was blown away at when I got the LinkedIn request. And this was 3 years ago or so. When I got a LinkedIn request from Tom Hopkins, I was like,
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah,
that is cool.
Yeah, interesting.
So I got this LinkedIn request. I'm in bed. I look at my phone, and I'm like, and Debbie's there, and I'm like, going, oh my God, Tom Hopkins just sent me a LinkedIn request. And so then I'm like, so I write back immediately. I go, Tom Hopkins, I can't believe that you're connecting with me, and so then I sent him an email. And this probably wasn't Tom himself, but it was probably somebody else. But anyway, 2 weeks later, I found myself having lunch with Tom Hopkins in Scottsdale, Arizona. And so that was a really cool deal. Of course, you know, I got to meet here more recently and build a relationship with Grant Cardone and now Glenn and Mindy Stearns. And so, and the way I met Grant was through EXP and then Clubhouse, but he did that second season of Undercover Billionaire. And then while I was watching that, we watched the first season, which was Glenn Stearns' season. And then I was like, oh man, really want to meet Glenn Stearns. And then met him at Grant's house place in Miami. And now we've got Success Lending. So we've got this new relationship. So, I probably now know three billionaires now. So, and I didn't know any before I was a billionaire.
Yeah.
So Glenn, just so much kindness and very humble. And as a success coach, it humbles me to be able to talk to you because I'm not a real estate agent. And so I see what EXP does, and I've been around EXP real estate agents, and I've seen the impact that you've made. But it just to know that the man I'm essentially working for and with is as humble and kind as you are makes me very happy. So thank you for everything.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Success Coaching Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow or subscribe to the Success Coaching Podcast at your favorite podcast provider. For special access to past recordings, videos of past episodes, and more, please become a Success Coaching Podcast companion at successcoachingpodcast.com.